Hello to our Faith and Reason 360 listening audience, and welcome to another interesting podcast, one that I think you will find quite motivating. I'm Deborah Dykes, and if you listened to our most recent Faith and Reason 360 podcast, you know Anne was only days away from giving birth to a daughter. Well, she did. Abigail was born only a few days after our recording. She's healthy and she's absolutely beautiful. So while Anne is tending to Abigail, I'd like to welcome David Dykes as our co-host today. David is not only executive director of the D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation, he happens to be my wonderful partner. Hi, David.
Hi, Debo.
We're really glad you're here today.
I'm very glad to be here. In fact, I'm kind of honored and impressed. This is a happening thing you're doing.
This is good. Thanks. Well, I've mentioned in previous recorded podcasts that support for Faith and Reason 360 comes not only from the Dykes Foundation, but also from the Joe B. and Louise P. Cook Foundation. And I am thrilled today to have as our guest the director of that foundation, Barbara Wendland, who is a lifelong member of the United Methodist Church, a graduate of Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, with degrees in math and theology, an author and co-author of several books, including Misfits, The Church's Hidden Strength, and is the first recipient of the prestigious Advocate for Public Religious Literacy Award given by Westar Institute. And inspired by Barbara, our conversation today is about hastening change in the church. Now, okay, some of you in our listening audience may ask, why does the church even need to change and why quickly? So I'd like to go directly to Barbara and ask her to talk about her vision for radical change in the church. Barbara, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Welcome. We are thrilled you're here.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you today.
Well, and I know that this is your first podcast recording, so this is going to be an adventure.
Right.
Well, Barbara, let's just go right to it. I'm referring to the comments that you made in an August publication that you do and in your connections. And in August 2017, you talked about changing the church, and under this section called It's Time for Radical Change. So I'd just like to know, will you talk a little bit about that? And what do you mean by radical change in the church?
Well, I basically see three main areas in which I think the church urgently needs to change. And I think these are radical in the sense that they really go to the root of what the church is all about and what it does. The first of those three areas is the need to update or make some changes in the official beliefs put forth by the church, in the doctrines that it still, and many churches still advocate as true, because those doctrines, the ones we're the most familiar with that come from the creeds that we, some of the doctrines we recite as part of the Apostles' Creed or something else like that, those originated in the 3rd or 4th century, which is so long ago,
right,
that the level of information about the world, about human beings and everything was so different from what we have access to today. And I think it would just be unthinkable, for example, if we were to go to a doctor and expect him to use only the knowledge that came from the 3rd or 4th century. We want him to, or her, to have the most up-to-date information there is. And yet, so many go to church and have a completely different way of looking at things. They stand and recite these statements that originated in sometime like the 3rd century that are really just incredible in the light of what we know today. And so that's one big way in which I think we need to change. We need to stop having people recite every Sunday morning, for example, that Jesus was born of a virgin and that he rose physically from the dead. That is, I think most people who hear it assume that to mean physically from the dead.
Of course, yes.
And so I think that's a big change that's needed. But I think there are very few church members who would like to see that change made. It would just be a shock to them.
Yeah, it pushes them past their comfort zone, obviously. But
well, because they've been taught for nearly 2,000 years that if you question any one of these statements, then that comes from a lack of faith or a lack of conviction.
Right.
And so we make people afraid to even want to ask why that phrase or that statement, what that means, when it almost is unintelligible for people in the 21st century, these things that meant something in the 3rd century.
Right. And I think the same thing essentially applies to how we present the words of the Bible, because much of it was written or spoken long before even the 3rd or 4th century. And there's no way that we can interpret those literally today as if they were still word-for-word rules to apply to today's life and today's people. Mm-hmm. And yet that's the way they're presented so often in the church. So I think all of that kind of thing urgently needs some change. And it's not just in the things that we recite, for example, in typical worship services, but it's in a lot of the hymns that we sing, for example, and just in people's conversation, the conversation of church members. They talk and think as if these things could be taken literally and still applied to today's world.
Mm-hmm. And Barbara, you had mentioned 3 areas. I don't want to neglect you having an opportunity to talk about those areas of your concern. So, have I missed something? Are there
I just think that one is that number one is a really big area.
But it is. It is.
Another, the second one that especially concerns me is the need for the church to be more active in combating injustice. I think that has to do with injustice of various different kinds. We're aware now that there is so much economic injustice in today's world, so much inequality between the top level of income and the bottom levels of income. And I feel like the church really needs to address that. We certainly need to address the injustice of how different kinds of people are treated just because of something like what the color of their skin is, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. what their sexual orientation is, or where they live, just all sorts of things that there's so much need to address, I think, and the church needs to do that.
Before you go to 3, I want to ask a question. A lot of churches offer these charity programs, so they have soup kitchens, and then they collect groceries, and then they provide clothing. They do these coat drives where they provide warm clothing for people. But those are charitable gifts, and there's nothing wrong with charity. But do you see that as something that the church does that they kind of enable those injustices instead of actually addressing those injustices, or am I?
Yes, I think that quite often is what happens. And in fact, I've just finished reading a couple of really interesting books that deal with that very subject. One is named Toxic Charity, and the other one by the same author is, I've lost track of its exact name, but it's something like Charity Detox. And also another one named Evicted that really, really get to the subject of how we tend to just give so-called charitable gifts rather than addressing the underlying problems.
Well, because to address the underlying problems is a real challenge for many people who want to be and mean to be within the Christian communion, but they don't they don't want the church to dabble in these kind of things. The first thing they'll do is to cry out, that's the church playing politics. And of course the response is no, it's not. It's the church concerned about what biblical God was always concerned about, and that is justice. And it was a special kind of justice. As Americans, we tend to think justice means putting bad people in jail.
Yes, but that's not what we're talking about here at all.
That's right. Justice, if you read the prophets, what God seemed to be most concerned about was, does everyone have enough to eat, basically? Do they just have enough to make it? So when you start talking that way, a lot of people want to talk about charity and taking Christmas dinner and Thanksgiving dinner to people that are poor. And as Dom Crossan says, there's nothing wrong with that, but don't ever confuse that with justice, because justice aims at changing the way we do things.
Right, changing some of the systems that cause many people to be poor.
Right.
Yes. Well, anyway, I think that's a really important need for the church to do more about than it currently does.
Yes.
And the third thing that really concerns me is the church presenting Christianity as if it were the only true religion.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I actually had a connections reader write me one time that said Christianity is the only true religion because it's the only one that was delivered by God. That's incredible to me that anyone could think that, and yet that really is the impression that the church too often gives. And I think that if we learn anything about other religions and other parts of the world, other cultures, it's just obvious that Christianity is one of many religions that I assume all arose more or less for similar reasons of people trying to figure out how to explain what they saw happening around them.
Yes.
But to say that we have the only truth and the only answer and that the Bible has the only truth is just really misleading. And it's no wonder to me that a lot of today's people are not interested in being part of the church when they see it making claims like these.
Yes. Well, you know, my father used to say, you know, people often will tell you that what you don't know can't hurt you. Well, the truth is, what you don't know often hurts you.
Yes.
And the unwillingness for anyone to say, I don't care about what you call science or fact or all of that. I care about what God cares about. Well, it so happens that if you believe that this being you're calling God is also the creator, then the creator would probably be interested in the mechanics of how the universe works. And so to say that science and fact finding and research is against God is to split God in two. So because it's if the Creator created humans and other life, and our greatest gift is our brain, our ability to figure out how to live, how to find water, how to take care of children, all of that, then having knowledge would fit into a faith that cares about what God started out to do.
Right. And I think another big problem that disturbs me about the way most churches present things to their hearers is the picture of God that they present. It really, when you think about it, it's like what they are describing is God, either explicitly in what they say or just in the way they act. It sounds more like a Santa Claus-like man that's up in the sky somewhere. And you think about the way we describe Santa Claus, this being up there somewhere, we don't know where, but presumably up in the sky, who does things for us sometimes, gives us what we want if we ask nicely for it and if we're well-behaved. But then again, sometimes Santa Claus doesn't bring us all the things that we ask for, and we may not ever know exactly why he brings us some things we want and brings us some other things we don't want. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly the way God is so often presented in the church. Yes.
I think that you're right. I don't think people really take into consideration the fact that they do too often, and the churches too often present God in that kind of Santa Claus metaphor. And of course, you touched my hot button in when you said a man, because of course,
oh yeah,
you know, the fact that people identify God as male, you know, that's kind of an idolatry point of view, because anytime, you know, idolatry, anytime you worship something or someone, then they become an idol. And of course, that also is the case when you refer to God in gender-specific language. So you're idolizing and creating an idol. It's idolatry. And I just am in complete agreement with you about that. And I'm concerned that people aren't even aware of that. It's become so routine to say Father that it's almost falls upon deaf ears. They do not even hear that it is gender specific.
Yeah.
And so, well, we could go off on that, but I'd like to come back to something else. Barbara, you, we are good friends, so we get to talk often, but I know that you are a lay United Methodist church person, that you've were raised in the Methodist Church. You're a lifelong Methodist. And so I have heard you claim to be a follower of Jesus. So why don't you just share with us, what does that mean to you, someone who embraces these ideas and yet you're a follower of Jesus? Help people understand that.
Well, in one sense, I do not claim to be a follower of Jesus.
Right.
That is, in the sense that I certainly do not live up to anywhere near all the things that Jesus taught and advocated. But I do see Jesus, I guess, as the goal that I try to aim at in trying to decide what to do and how to live, because I think that the teachings about love and justice, for example, that if we act on those, that would be the best way, or at least as good a way as any, to achieve happiness and fulfillment for the most people. And so I think it's important to try to aim at those things that Jesus taught, though presumably none of us are going to succeed in doing that perfectly. But and this gets back to the other religions in the world. I think that the reason that I and probably both of you feel that way about using Jesus as your goal in a sense of the word is that that's the way we were raised. Not only our families, but the whole culture and society and nation almost around us was centered on being Christian. And so we just saw that as really the only right way for a long time. And it still seems to me as good a way as any. But I feel like if I had grown up in India or China or somewhere else, I would see that very differently.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I think some of the people that did grow up in places and circumstances very different from mine, understandably, have a different way of looking at how to live their life, and it may have just as good result as some of what we do when we use Jesus as our pattern. Even though, I mean, I know I've read and heard that every one of the world's major religions has something like the golden rule, what we call the golden rule.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so to me, it doesn't, just saying, well, we follow Jesus doesn't mean we follow the only set of instructions that are valid.
Perfect. Excellent.
Well, you know, and the people, Barbara, that I have known in my life who were, I would say, the deepest spirits, so often not only listen to but read in other religions. And
yes,
they're informed by Buddha and by the Hindu religion and by Islam. And interesting thing I just thought of, and I had never really thought this thought through, is that Martin Luther King was probably one of the most amazing examples of a person living a life committed and shaped by faith in Christ, and mm-hmm. yet his model for nonviolent resistance was from a Hindu, Gandhi.
Yes.
So I guess I want to say, in the world of things spiritual, there's an interesting interaction between all the religions. Not, you know, we always talk about Islam and about Buddhism and Hinduism, and for instance, we never mention the Native American religions, and there's so mm-hmm. many, and again, people who are deeply interested in things that are spiritual and ultimate, some of the best speaker spirits in our history have come from that kind of background. So it just raises that whole idea that if we are followers of Jesus, who we call Christ, that doesn't shut us off from the rest of the world. That, in fact, makes us more able to be in conversation with and in relationship with people from other faiths and other cultures.
Yes, and I think especially in today's world in the U.S. today, we hear so many people saying negative things about Islam and saying, oh, it advocates all this cruelty and meanness and everything, and we are Christians who don't do that kind of thing. And yet they quote things out of the Quran that they've heard that are supposedly examples of how dreadful Islam is and all the terrible things it commands people to do. And yet you could pick out things equally bad out of the Bible where people are commanded supposedly by God to go and slay a whole bunch of people. And so, you know, so much of what Christians seem to do with the Bible is just to be terribly selective and pick out these few things that sound like what they want to believe and what they're used to, and they overlook all the ones that they don't know what to do with or that sound like what they don't want to mm-hmm. think is right.
Yeah.
Well, Barbara, it seems like there is a plethora of opportunities or ways in which people can make a difference, and particularly in the Christian tradition, in the churches
yeah.
of which, you know, is our origin. So, you know, you talk uh-huh. about these three areas that you see that are so important to you that you would like to see change, and, you know, you talk about the doctrines, the injustices, an inclusive religious perspective. And you consider yourself, I've heard you say, you consider yourself to be fortunate. And so
yeah.
with these issues of change that you see that we need, that needs to happen within the church, let's talk a little bit about a kind of an invitation or maybe a surprise invitation for our listeners that that is very dear to your heart. So you want to talk a little bit about how you see the possibility of these changes maybe happening and how you might
well,
help?
I don't know. I wish I knew a good answer to that. But I think the only way that they're likely to happen is if more of us who see the need for them speak up and try to make more people aware of the need for them. And I've tried to do that throughout my life in some things that I've, projects and organizations that I've worked with. And then also in the last very few years, as I near presumably the end of my life,
well, I hope not too soon.
Well, maybe not too soon, but after all, you yeah. know, we are moving along.
Oh, yes.
And I'm feeling more and more need to make some financial gifts, for example, to help some organizations that I feel like are working specifically toward helping accomplish these kinds of change that I see as needed. And I don't know that many of those changes will happen to any noticeable degree in my lifetime, but I feel like I still have to do the best I can to try to promote them.
Well, that leads me right into something that I want David to kind of talk a little bit more about, that part of the change that you're trying to make happen, and I know you live in Texas, and so there is a little bit of a focus on the area of Texas, but really anywhere, all over the world, in fact, there needs to be these changes presented. And you're making opportunities, or you're providing opportunities, or an opportunity for that to happen. And you have made that available to us here at the Dykes Foundation. And so let's move into this project that through your gift, Barbara, you are helping to do these very things, to promote critical thinking and to help inform people to push beyond the boundaries of their limited experiences with mm-hmm. confined within the doctrines of the church, but to expand the church and the people within the church a greater awareness of our responsibilities to one another. And so the Dykes Foundation is very fortunate that you have provided us with some funding, and we're producing an educational series that you're supporting. and it is called The Challenge of Paul. And I think our timing is very good for this production. And so I'm going to, Barbara, you have looked at some of these sessions on The Challenge of Paul.
Yes. Well, I have been fortunate enough to hear John Dominic Crossan speak several times, partly at times when the Dykes Foundation has presented him speaking in person somewhere, but also at some other times. And I've read a number of his books, and I feel like he, as a preeminent scholar of religion and the Bible and Christianity, is in ideal position to disseminate some of this information that is so badly needed within the church.
And I want to interject real here quick, Barbara, that John Dominic Crossan is featured in this Challenge of Paul series.
Yes, he is the star of it.
Yes.
He's the only person featured in it in person. And I liked in the sessions of it that I have watched, I thought it was really nice that he speaks in such a conversational style. You know, he doesn't speak in academic terminology and style. And sometimes when we read books by great theologians, they are addressing mainly other theologians.
Yeah,
and
yes.
It's kind of tough reading or listening for the ones of us that are not in that category, which I'm certainly not. But he is in this Challenge of Paul series. Listening to him and watching him is just very easy because he speaks in such a conversational way. And there's so much in the presentation that shows words on the screen of what he is saying, so that if you maybe had a little trouble wondering, you know, if he said, mentioned some place or some person, a historic person that you are familiar with, you would see it on the screen spelled out.
Yes.
And see maps of the places he's mm-hmm. talking about. So it's, I think that series is especially helpful for getting that information out.
Well, and I want David to step in for a moment because he is the producer of this series. And so those images, he has to almost perform magic to kind of get them present and visible. But David, say very quickly a little bit that how Dom takes Paul. So if those in our listening audience have a certain impression of Paul, is that impression necessarily accurate?
Well, you know, there's always a gap between the doctrine of different churches and history. It's not that they're lying about anything. That's not the point. The point is that over time, the stated and accepted beliefs of a given denomination get refined and added to, so that we lose or miss the opportunity to ask some basic questions like, oh, wait a minute. The Bible tells us about Jesus. Is there anything we're missing? Well, it turns out, yeah, there's a lot you're missing if you only look at the Bible, because the Bible does not pretend to be definitive about a historical person. So mm-hmm. scholars like John Dominic Crossan help us to see what was the world like when actually Jesus was born into it? What did Jesus have to contend with? And in the work that's called Historical Jesus Scholarship, Dom Crossan and other colleagues, Marcus Borg and Walter Brueggemann and others, they help us see that there was a real-life person living in the first century who had to deal with the major thing that everyone in the first century that lived around the Mediterranean had to deal with. Rome and the Empire of Rome was in charge. They were the landlords. And so Jesus and other poor or people or peasants living in Galilee had to wake up every day and live their lives with the Romans on their back. So, you know, Christian doctrine has people think that what Jesus was mainly concerned with was salvation. What happens to you when you die? And the truth is, Jesus spent most of his time caring about the poor and caring about those that were afflicted and those that were dominated.
And so, what happened to them while they were still on earth.
That's right.
Alive.
And he never seemed too concerned about what happens to us after we're dead. And yet, if you hear the church and its popular gospel talked about, all he really cared about was that you're saved from going to hell when you die. Well, no wonder the church has not made its main business to seek justice for God's people, because you have everybody that's believing this, believing that the most important thing is what happens to them, their souls, when they die. Well, I'm going to make this short. Dom Crossan, John Dominic Crossan, as a historical scholar, has not only done great work around historical Jesus, he's also done it now on historical Paul. Paul's probably the most maligned, misunderstood figure in all of Christendom. And part of what Dr. Crossan does in this series is to take a look at all that criticism of Paul and establish which of these statements or critiques of Paul are fair and which ones are totally baseless. Well, it turns out that historical Paul was much different than most Christians understand today. And it's refreshing and even energizing to hear him talk about who historical Paul actually was.
I want to point out to people that the Challenge of Paul, this educational series, themes 1 and 2, because of a generous gift from Barbara, is available to churches and individuals all over the world, and it's free. So towards the end of the program, I will help people with an email address so that if they're interested, they'll be able to contact us and receive this as a gift from Barbara. But Barbara, I want to go to something else now. I know that you are someone who promotes compassion and that you're very sensitive about justice, and you're an advocate for kindness and compassion and awareness. And you've written a book. You wrote a book several years ago, and I happen to put my hands on that book. I have had a copy for quite some time, but will you just share with people your book, Misfits? It really, when I picked it back up again, I was struck by how powerful this book is, and I'm wondering how many people are experiencing what you have experienced. And will you just kind of highlight a little bit about that book and how you came to write it?
Oh, it's too long a story to tell here, I think.
The highlights.
Read the book. But, as you mentioned, I grew up in the church, really active in the church. My parents and all of my grandparents and my husband's parents and his grandparents were all Methodists, very active Methodists. So I really was just totally saturated with life in the Methodist Church for the first 40 or 50 years of my life without even questioning anything about it. I just sort of did whatever the church said you were supposed to do, and I held the offices and did the jobs and made the contributions and everything because I thought that was what I was supposed to do. And there were some things that didn't make sense to me, really, about what I heard at church. But I didn't ever hear anybody else questioning them or even hinting that they felt they didn't make sense. And so I just kept quiet. I wasn't about to put myself out there to be criticized by those people for saying something that was all wrong. And I just I assumed that there must be something wrong with me, that I hadn't yet caught on to why all those things were right. Some of these things that we mentioned earlier, like the Santa Claus God and the things about Jesus that came from the 3rd and 4th century, and the Christianity being the only true religion, I heard those things and I thought, no, that can't be right. But everybody around me seemed to think, well, it's okay when they heard that in church. And so I thought, I'll keep quiet. And my mother helped me with this a lot. She and I were very close. And mm-hmm. when the rare occasions when I would say something about something that I thought didn't seem quite right or didn't make sense, she would say to me very sweetly, well, when you get older, you will see why this is right, or why this is the right way, the way we need to do it.
Oh, no, and, oh, no.
And I'm an only child, and I was close to my mother, and I just, at that time, I thought, whatever mother says is right. So I just accepted that, and strangely, you'll think I'm really crazy when I say this, but I didn't catch on to what was wrong with that statement of hers until one time when I was 50 and she was 80 and she said it to me.
Oh.
And I thought, whoops, you know, I'm never going to get enough older for this.
You're not old enough yet. You're not old enough yet.
No, I'm not. But anyway, when I was finally around 40 or 50, after having lived this very conformist sort of robot-like life as a churchgoer and a follower of rules in every way, I suddenly started wondering about some of these things enough to try to investigate and see if I could find out why they didn't seem to make sense and what the problem was. And I started reading and reading. I've always been a voracious reader.
Yes.
So I started investigating a lot of that, and I discovered a lot of these things that the way I'd heard them presented really didn't make sense, and that there was a lot more to the story than I was aware of. And I began thinking, what is the real purpose of the church?
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, my local church was in sort of turmoil, and some people were dropping out and so on, but my husband and I were determined to stay in. And it made me wonder more than ever about all this and to start investigating. And so that led on and on, and finally I felt like there must be some more people out there somewhere who are concerned about some of these same things and wondering about these same things I am. I didn't know any of those people. the people around me in my church and our friends and all didn't seem to be thinking about any of that. But I thought some people must be out there, and I've got to find them. And so I looked for them finally by going to a seminary. And I found there were lots of them there who were interested and concerned about that same thing. And I got also involved in the areas of the Methodist Church beyond the local church.
Right.
I got more involved in the annual conference and the jurisdictional, and finally to be a delegate to General Conference, the top governing body of the United Methodist Church. And I found a lot of people who were what I think of as kindred spirits and being concerned about these same things I was concerned about. But I also found that a lot of them felt like misfits mm-hmm. in their local congregations and their local communities. And so that's all of that led me finally to write the book about it, because I am writing Connections for the 25 years I've been writing it. I've heard from an awful lot of readers of it who write me and say, oh, I'm so glad somebody is saying these things, because I've been thinking in them for years, but I didn't know anybody else who thought that way. I thought I must be crazy, and I thought I was the only one, and so on. So I just finally felt like I want to say to those people, you are not crazy. You are not mistaken in some of what you're observing. And you are far from alone.
Right. In fact, there are thousands, you have thousands of individuals who I know every month I look forward to hearing your words that you offer with Connections. And there are people who are clamoring to read Misfits, The Church's Hidden Strength. And I think it is. I think that's an excellent title, because these people are, many of them are still hidden within these churches. Yes. And
well, they're afraid to speak up because they feel like somebody will think they're crazy, or that they will be the only one.
Or they'll be shunned, and they certainly don't want that. So, well, Barbara, this, I don't even want to stop, but I know we're running close on time, so I do want to recap just a little bit. I want to encourage people. Now, if someone wants to get a copy of your book, Misfits, The Church's Hidden Strength, how can they do that?
Well, they can go to Amazon or wherever else they'd like to order books from. It's available on Amazon, and if they wanted to get a copy from me that I could autograph even, they could get in touch with me and let me know. I have a website, which is www.connectionsonline.org, and all the back issues of my Connections are there, and my email address is there. And so anyone who wanted to know more about any of this kind of thing, or to get a copy of Misfits straight from me, could go there and find out how to do it. But the easy way is just order it the way you order any other books online. Unfortunately, it's not available in electronic form like for Kindle.
Right.
But it is still very available in paperback form.
Well, there are some of us who still like the feel of the tangible book in hand. Well, I do also want to remind people that The Challenge of Paul, featuring John Dominic Crossan, who is the world's renowned historical Jesus scholar, it is available, themes 1 and 2, and that can be purchased. Not purchased, because it's a gift. So that's available on by contacting me through our website. And that email address is faithandreasonproductions@gmail.com. And I will spell that quickly. FAITHANDREASON PRODUCTIONS@gmail.com. faithandreasonproductions@gmail.com. And whew, I think we've given them a lot of information. Also, you can always go to our website if you cannot understand quite what we're saying. And our website is faithandreason.org. And you can contact me there or David there. But Barbara, I I hope you've enjoyed this. It's been great.
Oh,
I mean,
yes.
It's been fun. I want us to do it again. I think that our listeners hear your passion and your commitment to helping find ways to teach a more positive and thought-provoking in content for people in congregations and helping people to reflect more deeply about their faith. And David, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. What a treat
I
for
enjoyed
me.
It.
So if you have any questions, again, www.faithandreason.org. Barbara, thank you. David, thank you. This program is produced by Faith and Reason, a program of the D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation.